This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Benjamin Netanyahu was recently platformed on Jordan Peterson's channel. This war criminal spewed lies, misinformation, which we will deconstruct in this episode.
The Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam told us, whoever builds a mosque for Allah, Allah will build for him a similar house in Jannah. And we know the great reward that will not only be gained, but rather will fill your grave after your death. Whenever someone prays there, whenever someone gives shahada in the masjid, whenever someone learns something in the masjid, yes, that will be something that you'll have on your scale.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
How you doing? You okay?
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah.
Abdullah Andalusi, for those who don't know, is a prolific debater in the Muslim world. I don't know how many debates you've done. Maybe over 100 now.
I lost count after 10.
And what? And one other thing that you have done is debate Zionism with Zionists. Isn't that correct? And so what we're going to be doing today is we're going to be reacting to the podcast between Jordan Peterson and Benjamin Netanyahu, dissecting the claims of this charlatan, this war criminal that was left unchecked and unchallenged by Jordan Peterson, which is absolutely disappointing to say the least, considering his interactions with the Muslim community. And quite frankly, when I looked at the comments and the engagements on this particular video, 30,000 people commented, and it was almost an 80 to 90% disapproval rating from the people. People really disliked it, and I was very surprised to see that. What do you think of it?
I don't think I was surprised at all. I think everyone sees through the kind of facade of Jordan Peterson's kind of almost presumed or objectivity, where he claimed at the beginning of the interview that he would push back on what Benjamin Netanyahu was saying and ask critical questions, what have you, and he didn't push back at all. If you actually watch the whole interview, in fact, when Benjamin Netanyahu was just waxing lyrical about his making points unchallenged, Jordan Peterson even sometimes helped him, said, oh, you forgot to mention this, helped him. Yeah. There's not a single time he pushed back on anything, despite him explicitly saying he would push back.
Well, I mean, in the past, I've spoken to Peterson twice, actually, and he was right and good to say that what he said about the Prophet Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam being a warlord was injudicious, in his words. It was a lack of judgment. But if we're talking about warlords here, I mean, this is an individual, Netanyahu, who I remember on the news coming out and talking about Gaza, and saying we want to conquer conquests of Gaza in the modern age of the UN and all these kind of things. What? Tell us a bit about who this Netanyahu is. Why do we feel so emotional about this guy?
Well, Netanyahu represents a more hawkish kind of Israeli response to Palestinian defiance.
Yes.
So we've seen increased numbers of settlements, accelerations of the building of settlements on the West Bank, which are basically virtually exclusively only for Jews, not even for Israeli Arabs.
Yeah.
We see the bombing of Gaza regularly. We see provocations on the Temple Mount. We see extrajudicial killings of Palestinians that do not get answered by the courts. We see arbitrary military rule in the West Bank, in Area C, where Palestinians are subject to military ordinances. They don't even get to decide their laws, and they get evicted. We see high levels of evictions of Palestinians out off of their homes and properties under his watch. So he's, out of all the prime ministers that's ever been in Israel, he represents one of the worst kinds of, worst of the worst. That's saying something, considering the history of Israeli prime ministers.
Well, I think after this particular thing, you know, came out and I saw his face with Jordan Peterson's face, I'll be honest with you, it was disgust when I saw him and disappointment. But then also there was a bit of the opportunist in me started to actually activate, if you like. And I thought to myself, so between me and one of the biggest enemies of the Muslim world today is one man who I've spoken to and I've had personal relationship with. And I'm sure that they're going to be watching this video. I'm 100% sure that those individuals, Daily Wire and Ben Shapiro.
And
Netanyahu himself. It would not be far away for me to assume that Netanyahu himself, who got, you know, 700,000 views, which is much less than one would have expected in the podcast with Peterson, and with an 80% disapproval rating with the right-wing audience, which is even more surprising, is watching this as well. Let's go through some of the main points of what he said and react to them in kind, should we?
Unfortunately, it's going to be it's quite a few. I was disappointed in Jordan Peterson because, he's psychiatry and psychology. He's very well-versed in that. He's achieved, he's accomplished, he's a writer in those things. And he's venturing out into an area that he doesn't really know, which he admits. But if you are going to venture out into a new theme or area, no harm in doing so, at least do your homework. He didn't seem to reference or give any indication of any knowledge of any counterpoints to anything that Benjamin Netanyahu said, not reading any of the many Israeli authors who've criticized Zionism, who've criticized the Israeli government, or any Palestinian writings, or any even historians who are a bit more neutral or objective than Benjamin Netanyahu's brand of history would call for. We saw nothing. We simply saw him. He admitted that he had some ignorance in it, although he read Benjamin Netanyahu's book called Bibi, I think it was. So he read one book, and that was sufficient for him to go into the discussion. It reminded me when he engaged Slavoj Žižek on Marxism and socialism, and he just read kind of like Karl Marx's manifesto, as if that's the only book Karl Marx ever read, and then felt that he was confident enough to debate a socialist academic who's highly acclaimed, world famous academic, on the nuances of socialism and Marxism. So the question is, why is Jordan Peterson, who is used to academic rigor in his field, he knows what it looks like. He knows what it looks like to be objective in scientific investigations, as much as you can concerning the human psyche and the mind. He knows what that looks like, and yet he does not adopt that same approach.
I'll be honest with
on
you.
These other areas.
I'll be honest with you. I think that Jordan Peterson and the Zionist issue, right? He's not a heavyweight of the issue, and he knows it. He's not one of the guys that's going to come out. And quite frankly, if someone beats him on this issue from, let's say, the pro-Palestinian side, I would consider it to be a worthless victory, because it's like he's not one of the guys that's been coming out debating like yourself, coming out talking to prominent speakers and academics from the other side. And so, quite frankly, I think that the attention should be put to those colleagues of his, okay, who have been making an argument, people like Ben Shapiro, people like Netanyahu, who today, inshallah, we're going to be dealing with. Because quite frankly, those are the ones who are making the arguments. Those are the ones who are writing the books. Those are the ones who, if you want to have a fight with someone, you want to have the fight with the best ones. Jordan Peterson, you know, this is not a matter of, we're not talking about a clinical psychological issue here. So once again, he was used by the Daily Wire. And I think the Daily Wire should take responsibility for actually damaging his reputation, quite frankly, because they've now damaged his reputation from his own standards. And I think,
but he's not a puppet, you know, like he should know better.
But if
he's being used,
consider this point though, okay, if you think you have a right wing or right audience or something like that, and you've got an Israeli politician, how do you know that 36,000 people are commenting, 80% of them are going to really hate what you say? Think of it from his perspective. And then when you put up an Instagram post, you know, 90% of the people are disliking him. I think he underestimated, quite ironically, the extent to which he appealed or transcended the right wing. And now that very reality is coming back to haunt him, because those individuals who are subscribers and fans of his are not going to have this kind of guy coming out and speaking the way he has about Palestine.
I actually think that Jordan Peterson actually should have known better. He knew that Benjamin Netanyahu is a controversial character, to say the least.
Yeah.
He even cited controversy. He said that there's amongst young people, because he cited in that interview that young people take a more pro-Palestinian view, I mean, in the academic circles and Western universities in the West. So clearly he had an agenda, or he was part of an agenda between the right wing and left wing. in the West. Maybe so you should have got this stuff.
I'm not sure if you remember the time when I spoke to Peterson. He had Jonathan. This I can't forget his surname, but he had his friend Jonathan with him, and then he was talking to me about why I was protesting. Maybe you should have got he should have gotten Jonathan to sit there and ask the hard questions. If, you know. At the end of the day,
the Catholic
or the equivalent of Jonathan, like someone who knows something about the Palestinian issue, should have gotten this guy to your right and start speaking about, okay, well, what about this? What about Gaza? What about the fact that Netanyahu was in his time premiership as a prime minister of Israel, he's the longest reigning prime minister. He oversaw indiscriminate killings, shelling of major apartment blocks where there's children being killed indiscriminately. As you mentioned, the settlement issues, we're talking about people being pried out of their homes, kicked out, new buildings being put. This is unbelievable. I mean, the
bombing of media, Jordan Peterson prides himself in freedom of the media, advocating for that, and yet Israel bombs media facilities, buildings which were designated for the media.
Do you remember that?
In Gaza. Yeah.
And quite frankly, you know, Jordan Peterson has been on the record speaking about Stalin and these guys of the past. But Netanyahu, I mean, he's one of them. He's worse than them. He's going to these places, dropping bomb, boom, 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 on big apartment blocks with the children being killed. And it's this is asymmetrical power and stuff like that. And Gaza, for those who don't know, Gaza is completely... What's happening in Gaza now? It is the most densely populated area in the world because they're not allowed to go in or out. These individuals...
It's a prison camp.
It's a prison. It's the biggest open prison in the world today. And there's not even one question about what about the people in Gaza? How is this? How can this be?
Well, Jordan Peterson talks about gulags and, you know, how, what the Soviets did to create these prison camps and things like this. And of course, the Nazis and so on and so forth.
Exactly.
What do you notice about a prison? What's the first thing that you notice when you're being taken to a prison camp?
Mm.
What's the first thing that you notice about the prison camp, right?
Mm.
It's the walls.
That's right.
The walls that keep people in. He went to Palestine and he should have seen the West Bank. All those walls and barbed wire and machine gun fences and turrets and so on and so forth, equivalent to the gulags that the Soviet Union created.
I don't know if genuinely we got the pictures of the children who were killed by this man. We showed him the pictures. This is a person under the rubble. This is the woman crying, screaming for her child, you know. This is another one. And this is a person being kicked out of their home. And this is a person... If we showed it to him, could it change his mind? Could it make him change? Could it make him different? It doesn't matter at this point. I don't care. Because quite frankly, as I've said before, we want the big fish here. We want the big fish in this debate. You know? So let's go through some of the things that we...
Well, like... I mean, watching it was very hard.
I'll be honest, yeah.
Because... not just Benjamin Netanyahu, who with a straight face can talk about justice, not despite the many faces of children that have been slain by him that we've seen on the news, and not necessarily mainstream Western media news, unfortunately. Not just that, but even the part of me that favors just factual accuracy, right? So not just my heart, but even just the part of me that favors factual accuracy, was grossly offended. He was lying blatantly to Jordan Peterson.
And at one point he was like, you know, I don't want to misquote him here, but he was saying like, people haven't really attacked him on the basis of facts.
I mean, like, Benjamin Netanyahu's books are comical. There's been loads of refutations of the claims in those books. He just reiterates them, rehashes the same rubbish that Zionists have come out with. And it's not an issue of that is disputed amongst academic circles. These are clear-cut facts of history and background.
Let's go through some of them.
Yeah.
So what? Give me some most egregious ones that you think then.
Well, he starts out by first discussing some kind of legitimacy behind the government of Israel's right to be... to be created and dominate Palestine, and even undermining, as they would usually do, you know, why call it Palestine? You know, that's a new term, it's a new phrase, and so on and so forth. And all of that is not true. And it starts out basically argumenting as who owned it first. Who owned it first? The Palestinians came later. An Arab invasion came in the 7th century.
What a ridiculous discussion!
So
the natives should have a discussion about this. Let's open the discussion about the natives and maybe the Anglo Saxons and maybe the Normans. You know,
but the irony, brother, is it's completely unlike he portrays. It's ironic, the history. Mm. So before I kind of wax lyrical about that, let's just rewind and just deal with it on an intellectual basis.
Yeah.
Because I think we need to kind of address it objectively. So if we go by the biblical account, okay, just by the biblical, and Benjamin Netanyahu cites the Bible, cites the Old Testament or the Tanakh. So he says that basically, he doesn't discuss, oh, wait a second, how did the Israelites ever get to Canaan, which was the first name for that land is Canaan, or at least that we have in the earliest mentions is Canaan, Canaan. Okay. How did they get there? Were they always there? It doesn't mention that, of course.
Yeah.
If we were going to look at it from a secular perspective, just a secular perspective, like, okay, and you take the Tanakh to be honest, the Bible to be an honest account, or you trust it, they were invaders. The Canaanites were basically indigenous people. They're living there. They had a belief that they were pagans. Their head god was called El. And people then will say that's kind of similar to the term that is used for God in modern Semitic languages and in Judaism and Islam and so on, so Allah or Allah, right? Mm. But they had maybe brought these partners in and worshipped all the partners besides that, the what was then we call the head god, right? They brought all the partners in. Anyway, that's their religion, but they were Canaanites, they were living there, Semitic peoples. So you had these, according to the Bible, you had these Israelites who came in, invaded from the east. They actually went around the south and went to the east. They began an invasion and they were told to massacre people. Mm. And not just kill the men and like or offer terms of surrender. Mm. No, wipe out men, women and children, even at one, some places, the oxen and the cows and what have you, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's their entrance into the land of Canaan, according to the Bible, which Benjamin Netanyahu kind of relies upon. Look at the historical record. Ironically, who controlled Canaan for hundreds of years prior to any recorded Israelite occupation by the archaeology? Well, it was the ancient Egyptians actually controlled Canaan up until about 1200 BC. Then there was something called the Bronze Age Collapse, where a bunch of civilizations in the region collapsed for all faced strife and turmoils. And then the ancient Egyptians kind of like let Canaan go and let the regional rulers of Canaan just kind of, who were previously vassals to them, just let them take over. And that's what happened. And then suddenly around about 1200.
So if there's any Canaanites that came today and said, we want to establish our state again.
well, you see, the funny thing is there are Canaanites. Yes. Okay. We just don't call them that anymore. Well, I'll get to that. No spoilers.
Okay.
All right. So what we see is that there is an early mention of something called the Ibri or the Ivrit, who was basically the Hebrews mentioned in an Egyptian stele, which is like a stone carving, around about 1200 BC. That's when they just pop into existence. We see then settlements which were identifiably Israelite just pop into around East Palestine.
So when was this? What were we talking about? What year?
So 1200 BC, that's basically 3,200 years ago.
Yeah.
Now, Benjamin Netanyahu said that they've got evidence for 3,500 years. That's wrong. Out by 300, but I'm not going to hold him to that. I'm not going to be nitpicking.
No, that's 300 years, a long time.
Well, yeah, but he said that there was even earlier evidence. Now, yeah.
So we're talking about 300 years, what can happen in 300 years?
Yeah.
And he was saying that he was not being, he's not being challenged on his facts. That's a major fact to me.
True. But I said, okay, I'm going to be generous.
No, we don't.
Right? I'm going to be generous. And and so, okay, allow the 300 years. But we have the biblical account that says that obviously Ibrahim alayhi salam has a son, Yaqub, has then a son, Yusuf. Hmm. And it was alleged that we all believe that he comes from Ur in modern day southern Iraq.
Yeah.
He migrates over to Canaan. And then his children, and then eventually Jacob lives in, Yusuf lives in Egypt and then has descendants, right?
Yeah.
That's the origin of the tribes of Israel,
yeah.
Okay? So they're not Canaanites. They were never, according to the Bible, they've never been Canaanites. They were just passing through and they multiplied in Egypt, mm-hmm. right? They settled in Egypt, they multiplied.
Yes.
Okay, and then they invaded Canaan, okay?
Okay.
According to the biblical account. According to archaeological account, if you don't want to use the Bible as a reference, you're purely secular, let's just say, Israelite settlements pop up in where we modern day West Bank, basically in about 1200.
Okay.
Now, interestingly, and this would become useful, interestingly, the name that would become Palestine comes from an Egyptian word called Pelesht, or P-R-S-T, it's also, these are consonants, used to describe a people that were believed to be invaders into the land of where Gaza is, right, and a bit north of that, called the Philistines.
Yeah.
Right? They're believed to be maybe people from Crete.
Yeah.
And they invaded. They had like feathers coming up, feather hats, and they brought pottery, which is typically Greek pottery. Mm. Anyway, so the interestingly, here's a funny thing. Why did I mention that? Well, because the Israelites would call them invaders, even though these guys only came 50 years after the Israelites. So they just came 50 years a bit later, right? Oh, but they're invaders. Well, then, but you're invaders too. You just came 50 years. You were, you know, ahead of them, right? Mm-hmm. But anyway, the reason why it's interesting is because the name for the land would then be used as Palestine, right? Where did that come from? And why do Zionists want to deny it being called Palestine? Why they say it must be called Israel? The land, the name of the actual land itself has never been called Israel.
Right? Yeah, of course.
Even in the time of the Kingdom of Israel.
Yeah.
Right? Do you know why? And this is one of these obvious truths that people don't realize is the name of a land is different to the people who control it. Yeah. So this is, you could call this Ingoland, land of the Angles, right? But it's actually the Britannia. Yeah. The name of the island is Britannia, but the area of the jurisdiction of a particular bunch of tribes of people are this is land belongs to the Angles. Right, it's not the same thing. So the land of Canaan was called Canaan by all the regional powers before the Israelites turned up. Then the next name that it was called was by Greeks and Romans, but most by ancient Greeks, Herodotus, in around 500 in the 6th century BC, who he names it by the people who are facing the coast, which are the Philistines, is their nickname. So they call it Palestinia or Philistia, whatever pronunciation. So that became the second name for the actual land itself. But in terms of the word Israel, Israel is the name of the tribe or tribes. And even in the in Zionist literature and in the Bible, it's called Eretz Israel, land of the tribe of Israel, not Israel. You see, so this land belongs to you had the Moabites, who was the land of the Moabites, the land of the Edomites. These were tribes that were all in the area, but they were living on Canaan. The land's called Canaan, but their jurisdictional area, they'll say this land belongs to this tribe, that tribe. So the land has never been actually called Israel.
Wow.
Right?
Wow.
And it's one of these shocking facts that people forget. So that's the history. Israelites were invaders. And I'll tell you a second shocking fact, right? So then they say, okay, so we were invaders, they might say.
Okay, yeah.
All right? But we've been there so long. Now it's been like, 3,200 years, so, you know, like, so we own it now, right? It belongs to us. Well, firstly, that also isn't true, okay? In fact, the real historical facts will shock you. And it's not even hard to find or controversial. Just think about it, okay? So let's say that we take the 1200 BC as the date that we see the earliest archaeological evidence for Israelites, 1200 BC, fine. Around 7th century BC, they got kicked out by the Babylonians. They go away for about 56 years, 60, 70 years, and they come back. But then around 70 AD, or CE, as it should be called, Common Era, the Romans, there's a massive uprising. Romans basically decimate Palestine, and they many Jews are kicked out. They go around the world. They spread. They were following revolts afterwards, and that led to more expulsions. Most of them not really expulsions by Roman policy, but when the land's devastated, burnt to a crisp, literally, there's no point staying anymore. You're starved. You have to go around the world. Okay, that's around 70 CE. Okay, so then let's make calculations. Okay, from 70 CE to the 19th century, when you saw Jewish Ashkenazi Jewish immigration. Ashkenazi are Jews that live in Europe or who settled in Europe, for example. You've got Italkim, which are Italian Jews, and you've got Sephardis, which are like Spanish Jews, and you've got Mizrahi Jews, which are Arab Jews, basically.
The ones who are subject to all kinds of racist attacks in Israel.
But yeah, basically, that's a different discussion.
Yeah, of course.
It's like a hierarchy of racism in Israel, basically.
Yeah.
Anyway, so what you see is all these Jews settled in multiple areas after the Roman devastations due to uprising. All right, but then if you do the calculations from 1200 BC to around 70 CE,
mm-hmm.
okay, so you're getting deducting maybe 60, 70 years due to an exile, right? You're pretty much getting roughly around 1,200 years. Okay, well, that sounds pretty solid. But then from around 70 CE to what, like the 1900s? Yeah, you're making concessions for subsequent revolts, remaining Jews that were there. You get roughly them being in the land about 1,000, them being out of the land 1,700 years.
Mm.
They've spent more time, the Ashkenazim, Sephardi, Mizrahi, because mm-hmm. Palestinian Jews that were there.
They've spent more time outside the land than inside.
Their ancestors have spent more time outside the land than they ever spent inside the land mm-hmm. in their entire ancestral history.
Wow.
And that gives them more ownership. If anything, that gives Ashkenazim Jews more ownership in Germany or more ownership in Sephardis in Spain and so on and so forth.
Let's be honest. I mean, like, let's say this country that we're living in now.
Yeah.
I mean, every kid that goes to school knows that you had the 1066 Battle of Hastings and this kind of Norman
invasions and
stuff like that, or William the Conqueror and all that kind of stuff, right? How comical, laughable, how much of a joke would it be if some French guy came on TV or something, or some guy who, let's say, from the Scandinavian countries, and starts saying, look, we have ownership of, because we've always been in this land. We've been here before you guys were, for example. Or England, as it was known, before the Anglo-Saxons. What was it? And then some, you know, groups come and start speaking about this.
Yeah.
It's this conversation can only, and will only be had with this particular issue. And the reason why is because there's a historical clutching at straws here, I think. I mean, no one's having this discussion with the Native Americans. Okay, well, if this discussion was normal, right? So let's talk about the fact that you have in Jordan Peterson's country, the First Nations. Okay, they were there before the white man came along, weren't they? So, okay, let's talk about, let's open up a discussion about whether the white man should have come to Canada and what kind of rights he has to come to Canada and so on. It's laughable. And in fact,
I mean,
they invaded the land in a way, and they went against their treaties a thousand times,
yep.
both the Americans and so on. They have no authority, really. Mm-hmm. They have no legitimacy to be there, no legitimacy whatsoever, zero. They overtook the land by force. So let's just call a spade a spade. You know, this discussion is a smokescreen. This whole discussion is a red herring, if you like. I think this whole discussion is the fact that they're talking about ancient history, to talk about a modern state, is a smokescreen, is a red herring. It's Netanyahu trying his best to appeal to the ancestral roots, to the historical memories of Jewish people, for example, of Christians and so on, and to try and evade the reality that this guy is a mass murderer. This guy's dropping bombs on apartment buildings. This guy is killing kids. This guy is taking women and children out of the house and telling them to go home. Go to another country. Go to another country in the Arab world. Look how big the Arab world is. This is the kind of conversations we're having.
But you see, smokescreen though it might be, these lies kill.
They do.
It's because of the claim that they're not colonialists.
Yes.
That they're just coming back to get what's theirs. And so then that means by default, that they're implying that the Palestinians are thieves and squatters.
Yeah, that's exactly what.
And any,
exactly what it said.
Yeah, and any resistance they offer is not only unjust, but could be a pretext to be met with force.
I want to know though if that's what it is. If we're talking about British common law and all the kind of thing that Peterson, I think it was Danny, one of his worst moments. British common law and this and squatting and this kind of whatever the conversation he had. If that is a conversation we can have now, can we open the dossier, historical dossier of American white Americans being thieves and squatters? Can we say now that the white American is essentially a thief and a squatter? That's what he is.
Oh, well, certainly. What they'll say is, well, what's done is done. He was even wrong about English law, common law anyway. He said he might mark it up, and indeed he did. So he said that if a people, so Benjamin Netanyahu said that if you come to a land that's desolate, he was claiming Palestine was desolate in the 19th century.
Yes.
And you build it up and you develop it, it becomes yours.
Yes.
And so then Jordan Peterson, pushing back, just agreed and said, "Yeah, there's something in English law, that allows you to something you could do something like that if you."
I think pound for pound, Canada's probably one of the most derelict places in the world. Pound for pound,
It's massive.
It's huge, and there's no who's there. Sorry to say, 30 million people, 4 million people. It's like the population of Morocco.
Well, people in Greenland should be scared now because they're going to get invaded anytime by anyone who could just say, here you go, I've made a McDonald's on your land now. I own it. The point is that these are lies that kill. The argument about ancestral presence there is a bad argument in many, many, many ways. It's ahistorical anyway. Mm. Benjamin Netanyahu argued that the Arabs were the colonialists. Mm. Okay. He said that they came in the 7th century. Mm-hmm. Right. And they came and they kicked out the Jewish farmer, which are blatant lies. You expect lies from people. But to lie so brazenly about something so easily disprovable.
Unbelievable, isn't it?
Is shocking because we know that the standard policy in the Muslim expansions was never to disrupt anyone living on any of these lands. Absolutely. It was under Roman control anyway.
But, do you know what else? Sorry to cut you off. Mm. I gave Jordan Peterson a gift actually right before we started that discussion. It didn't come on the thing. Mm. But it was the preaching of Islam by Thomas Arnold Walker. And I told him before we started, I said, this is an Orientalist writing this book. And this is an Orientalist in the, say, 19th century, 18th, 19th, 20th century, whatever it is, 100 years ago. And, he's not affected by wokeism or liberalism. So read it and see about the Islamic expansionism. Because if you, exactly the point you just made, he makes this point on Thomas Arnold Walker that when the Muslims went into these countries, when they went back into Jerusalem under Umar ibn Khattab, for example, that they were not forced to be converted, they were not kicked out of their lands or anything like that. This stuff is clear, even in Orientalist literature.
Jews were banned by the Romans from residing in Jerusalem.
Yes,
from a prior revolt. Omar Adanum reversed that. He let Jews back into Jerusalem. Yeah. And also, there was some Jewish tribes in Arabia. He allowed them to be relocated to Yeriha, which is Jericho, in Palestine. Wow. So he actually brought Omar bin Khattab, the second caliph of the Muslims.
After the Prophet Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi
Wasallam. Right. Yeah. Second caliph. He brought Jews into Palestine. Let them go back. Let them come back into Palestine.
Absolutely.
I mean, it wasn't under, I suppose, a deliberate policy of let's bring Jews in, but it was the case showing that if they want to live there, let them live there.
Absolutely.
So Muslims never had, we didn't kick out Jews. We brought Jews back in. And you know what? This leads to the second biggest lie of Benjamin Netanyahu's discussion, which Jordan Peterson, again, just did not push back on, which is that Arabs... or Arabic speak, just because people in Palestine speak Arab, and they're called Arabs, because anyone that speaks Arabic is called an Arab, that they only came in the 6th or 7th century is completely false. If you really don't want to take the history book's word for it, genetic tests will show anyone, Palestinian, Lebanese, Judean, Syrian, they have genetic connections to 4,000-year-old bodies, Canaanite bodies.
And that was the bombshell found in those, wanted,
well, that's one of the bombshells. But before I get onto that one, what happened was that Palestine was mixed with non-Jews since even the time of the Israelite invasions. There's always been non-Jews amongst Jews. Well, I say Israelites because they were all the tribes of Israel as well. They've always been mixed. Mm-hmm. Due to the revolts and what have you, Romans clamped down. But even before that, during the Alexander invasion of Alexander, quote unquote, the Great, there was Greeks living amongst them, or Greek speakers living amongst them. It was a mix of ethnicities, always has been. Mix of ethnicities amongst them. But when the Romans occupied it, again, more cosmopolitan, more mix of people living there. So there's been a mix. Not all of them are going to be Israelite. And amongst the Israelites, not all of them are Jewish. So from that, there are people then, when the Romans came, when the Romans became Christian, many Jews became Christian. Okay. And then from those who then became Christian, their descendants, when Islam came, they became Muslim. Mm-hmm. There were still Jews converting to Islam, even recorded until even the 19th century. The Ottomans noticed it. Mm-hmm. There were people, not under any compulsion. It was whole villages that were left basically autonomously, and then one family would convert to Islam, and then they'd start a chain reaction of conversions. Yeah. You'd also get people who were non-Jews but were Israelites, Samaritans, which are the remains of the remaining 10 tribes of Israel, whereas Jews are a mix of the last of two tribes, but mostly the Judean tribe, or tribe of Judea, or Judah, basically. They're what we call Jews, but you had Samaritans who converted to Islam, those that stayed behind and didn't convert to Islam and didn't accept the tribe of Judah's authority and kept their own Torah, which is a different version to the Torah, the Jewish Torah. So this was all going on in Palestine. It's a mix. Many Jews became Muslim, and then when they became Muslim and they were speaking Arabic, they're just called Arabs. And then when the British took over Palestine, they encountered a mixed people who had a mixed heritage all over the place. But Palestine is a crossroads. There's been people intermixing all the time.
That's a good point, man. That's a really good point.
I'll just show you some ironies of this intermixing. They mentioned, a famous Palestinian activist, I think it was called Muna Kurd, and her brother.
Yeah.
So, they say, their name is Kurdish, right? They're Kurds. Zionists argued they're not real Palestinians.
Really?
They're Kurds, right? They're the typical Kurds. A Kurdish person came over, intermarried the locals. But when you intermarry the locals, you become one of the locals. You know, you don't. But your name might stay behind. But even then, even if they were Kurdish, just to show you how intermixed the Middle East is, right? For anyone who's watching who's from the West and just doesn't know what the Middle East is all about, right? Middle East is mixed, always has been. When Kurdish DNA was investigated, they discover a high degree of Israelite DNA. Why? Because when the Kingdom of Israel split into two factions, you had the North faction, which called itself Israel, which is confusing, but they were called the Kingdom of Samaria, and then the South was Judah, right? The North got destroyed by the Assyrians, and the people were taken into captivity by the Assyrians, which is where the Kurds are today. That's where the Assyrian Empire is, right? And again, they intermixed. These people then just became Kurds, or just were Kurds eventually. And so many Kurds are Israelite in their ancestry. So technically speaking, Mona Kurd is just coming back home, if she is Israel, because of the intermixing. But that's the thing, that's the intermixing. If you look at the DNA tests, now going back to DNA tests, there's multiple studies done on Ashkenazi Jews, Mizrahi Jews, Arab Jews, Palestinians, Lebanese, and so on. And they noticed things which I think everyone with common sense would tell you, which is Palestinians, Lebanese, Mizrahi Jews have much more in common than Ashkenazi Jews.
Really?
Not saying Ashkenazi Jews don't have any connection to there, But they've intermarried with Italians, with Germans for centuries.
Yes.
Okay. In some cases, their DNA is in one study was only 50% from the Levant, whereas the average Palestinian is 70% from or 80% from the Levant. They did studies on they found old bodies of Canaanites from 4,000 years old, not 3,200 years or 3,500 years according to Benjamin Netanyahu, 4,000 years. Again, about 80-90% match to Canaanites, Palestinians, really? Lebanese. Yeah, because everyone's been intermarrying in that region for centuries. Right? So it's just, you might have like foreigners come in and intermarry the locals, but then their children become pretty much part of the local DNA.
That's the futility of making a genetic argument almost. I mean, that's what it is, our people. What do you mean by our people? Are you talking about people that believe in a certain religion? Because obviously Judaism, what is a Jew? A Jew is it's an ethnic religious group. So you've got the religious component, but you also got the ethnic component. But it seems to me like when they talk about Jews, especially in the political context, they are speaking about the ethnic Jew. They are speaking about the Jew that's, it doesn't matter what he believes or what she believes, especially someone like Netanyahu, who is openly like, you know, a pro LGBTQ or whatever, things that would go against the Old Testament corpus anyway.
Brother, I will tell you something, now tell you something further shocking. It's about current day Israeli law and the right to return. Okay.
Yes, the Aliyah.
So the point about when people talk about ancestry, which you might think is like, what's the point about him? Because he went on and on about ancestry.
Yes.
Benjamin Netanyahu went on and on, my ancestral right. Okay. Well, firstly, if the vast majority, the majority of Jews in the world are Ashkenazi Jews, yes. Germany or Italian Jews, right? Study after study has shown that they're pretty much as much German and as much Italian as they are Jewish, as they are from the Levant, from Al-Sham, from that area, genetically speaking. Mm-hmm. So they could make an equal genetic or an ancestral claim to Germany or Italy as they could anywhere else. Yeah. So then why does that give Ashkenazim or Italkim more right than the Palestinian whose ancestors have mostly been in that same region for a longer point in time, and were probably Jews, many of them were Jews had Jewish ancestry themselves. That's one point. But the ancestry argument is, a lot of it is based on my ancestors own the land, therefore I inherit it. That's the whole point of the argument that he was bringing on, and it's just ridiculous. It's like the Anglo-Saxons in England, or the English people, saying, and they've only been here for, they came roughly around, 9th centuries. So let's just say 1,300 years-ish. Them saying, hey, we come from Germany originally. So we have a right not only to go back to Germany and get citizenship, but we have a right to create our nation state and make the Germans the minority in some way, right? That we have a privilege, a preference. That is
it's embarrassing. So one thing I would say is that obviously Israel itself, I mean, almost all organizations, apart from obviously the pro-Zionist ones, have labeled it as an apartheid regime. The reason why it's an apartheid regime is because of its racist, you know, treatment of, say, for example, Arabs. Can you tell us something about that?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, when they mention that they look into ancestry rights, they're not really serious about that. It's because they have a law about the right to return.
Yeah.
But it's not the right to return to everyone that's ever had any ancestry in that land, because there are many, you know, I said many Arabs or Palestinians or whoever who have Canaanite ancestry. They'll never give them citizenship. But they have the law specifies that not only can Jews claim a right to return, but only on condition that those Jews basically have not converted to another religion.
Really?
So a Jewish person of Jewish ancestry on both sides of the family, mother and father, converts to Islam or Christianity, they will not be able to claim the right of return to the land of Palestine.
Wow.
Even though their ancestry hasn't changed. It doesn't change because you convert to a different religion. But if you're an atheist, or if you're a Jewish Jew, then that's fine. Then your ancestry somehow matters now.
Wow.
So this just shows you that they don't really care about ancestry exactly. It's about the supremacy of a particular identity.
Right.
And what most people forget is that the kind of the major, the main Zionist movement that was successful in getting the beginning of the Israeli project to incept Israel, were not actually religious Jews. The vast majority of them, Ben Gurion himself, were atheist socialists.
Mm.
Right, they were nationalists and socialists, and they believed in Jewish nationalism. They felt that only we're having a national state for Jews could they implement a socialist system for the Jewish people, and that's what they didn't believe in religion. For them, it was just a kind of a romantic historical land that was useful. But Theodor Herzl, one of the main advocates of political Zionism, the one who really kind of got the ball rolling seriously, he didn't even care so much if it was even Palestine they get. They said, well, maybe if we Uganda. Get a place in Argentina.
Oh, okay.
But Argentina was actually what they were
for. What was the discussion about one of the African countries? That was Chaim Weizmann. Uganda, was it? Or
Uganda was what was one option, but yeah. It wasn't as serious. Actually, as Argentina was actually a serious option. The point that Herzl didn't know whether he would pick Argentina or Palestine, because he felt that Argentina had more arable land. It was much more good for growing things and living there, whereas Palestine was more arid. So he actually preferred Palestine. He even argued, even mentioned that Jews don't speak Hebrew anymore, but majority. So he didn't really even care whether they spoke Hebrew, whether they lived in Argentina. He wanted a national state for Jews, regardless of where it was going to be.
And I remember reading the letters that Chaim Weizmann wrote back and forth, and this Uganda option. And you know, he was like, you know, but this is not our, you know, our homeland or whatever it is. And there was this discussion this right before the Balfour Declaration, actually. So it's a very interesting part of history. And if you look at it from a secularist perspective, I don't see any justification of this stuff ever being even plausible. I mean, but once again, it's as if they're living an alternate reality, but it's being entertained by the likes of Jordan Peterson, unfortunately. Now, I was going to ask about this, well, I would say one of the thrusts of main central, the crux of his argument, really, which is that, you know, Palestine was desolate, was derelict, and these Arabs were not doing anything with it, quote unquote. Therefore, the Jewish man needed to come in, for example, the Jews needed to come in, to make something of the land, as Jordan Peterson, I think, said. What do you think of this?
Well, the claim that, you know, Mark Twain and...
and he kept mentioning Mark Twain. Pathetic.
They came in and they described Palestine as desolate. What they don't mention is that Mark Twain went to Syria and Lebanon and Greece and said the same thing. Desolate, empty, barren.
Oh, really?
Because there's a lot of areas that are basically desert.
Oh, if you went to Canada, what would he say?
Yeah, pretty much. but what they don't tell you is that many of these... Why these Christian American, many American Christians were very interested in going to Palestine. There was a lot of interest.
Mm.
Was because of their messianic belief that the Jews would return back to Palestine before the advent of Christ, so to hasten the return of Jesus, you know, maybe encourage things along, bring the Jews back. So that they were it was Christian Zionists who in a way were the first highly vocal Zionists in the West, and they weren't Jews. And they were the ones who were coining phrases like a land without a people for a people without a land. They were trying to encourage it. So they were going there and just saying, yeah, it's all barren, it's empty, because there's massive deserts. I mean, the Negev desert in Palestine is pretty barren now. You know, does that mean now that they would accept Arabs coming back into the... Well, they wouldn't. So just by saying there's barren areas doesn't really change anything. They say that they came in and developed the land. That Palestine has been being developed and reconstructed with Al-Quds, built and expanded over centuries and centuries and centuries.
The Ottomans development projects there, didn't they?
They had the Hejaz Railway, which linked Arabia all the way, you know, going up to Syria, and you know, eventually to Constantinople, going through Palestine. They had trade routes via the ports in Palestine, exporting fruits. Palestine was known for fruits, actually fruit exports.
Still is actually the dates.
Yeah, of course, right? Of course, oranges and things like this. So it had all these different arable products that was produced. So it had development. It had farming lands. There was about, according to Ottoman censuses, there was about at least 500,000 people there. The people said that was underpopulated compared to before. But the thing is that the people in the land of Palestine has fluctuated for centuries and centuries. It's become quite heavily populated, then not so much.
It's such an unusual argument.
It's a weird argument. Like the people wouldn't mind them being kicked out of their homes and their land because there's some empty areas.
It's like, okay, so once again, the Canada argument, or even the Russia argument, or Greenland, as you mentioned. You know, I mean, is this the level of argumentation?
It's ridiculous. The Ottomans were modernizing the land before the British came and occupied it. So then, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu used an argument about his apartment, that it's equivalent of he owned an apartment, or his grandfather had an apartment, got kicked out, got taken over by people who then got kicked out pretty quickly, and then it was left as a mess. Then he came back to the apartment and rebuilt it, renovated, now it's his. No, if I was to use analogy accurately, it's someone who kicked someone else out of the apartment,
yes,
stayed there for a bit, got kicked out or left, left because things weren't working out there or what have you, got another home, spent most of their life in that other home, the vast majority of their life in the other home, and then felt like, hey, I want to come back to that apartment at some point. And even then, it's a cousin and cousin, a cousin, cousin, cousin of theirs. Mm-hmm. I want to come back to that apartment that my ancestors once took over at some point, and I'll kick out everybody that I don't like in there. And then the argument, and you know what? And the argument that we renovated it, it's like, I know.
Absolutely pathetic.
Imagine, you know what?
Head of state.
Do you know what? Imagine someone, right, stole your car, right? They stole your car,
yeah.
And then eventually the police found it, but he'd put some extra rims on it. And he says, it's my car now, judge, it's my car. I put rims, you know? I put some like leather trimmings and I got fluffy dice on the on the rearview mirror. It's mine now. Yeah. See, like, everyone that steals something does something with what they steal at some, you know, if they intend to keep it. Yeah,
it's true, it's like finders keepers, it's stealers keepers. I think he went to MIT. His father was meant to be actually a historian. And by the way, guess what his specialism was? His specialism was Jewish history in the golden age of Jewry. His father's, and obviously that was the Islamic.
That was the Islamic period.
Islamic Spain. So he knows all about Islamic coexistence, convivency, and all those kind of things.
Well, I said they were Palestinian Jews Palestinians who were Jewish, and as well as Samaritans, as well as Christians and Muslims, all living there in Palestine when the first migrations came. The first migrations came into Palestine under Ottoman period. They let it, but then there was so much influx that they tried. They said we're going to have some restrictions because you just can't have unrestricted migration into any territory. And then when the British came, they made a deal with the British, say, you know, we want to create a homeland, which Britain kind of gave because it was hoping to use Jewish influence in the United States of America to get them involved in World War One, to help them join World War One on the side of the British. The allies and so on and so forth. So even though, funnily enough, the British had promised it to Sharif Hussein, right, the Sharif of in Hijaz, who they said that if you help us, we'll give you al-Sham, we'll give you the whole area. They made the first promise to him. Of course, they broke that, and then they made the Balfour Declaration. Even though, technically speaking, the first promise is still binding. Yeah, so people try to often cite the Balfour Declaration gives them official sanction. That's false. I mean,
what this was just, what authority did they have to deal with these lands anyway? I mean, I promise you this land that's not mine, and I promise you that land that's not a thing. And the thing is, it's like it's demeaning that this is you're operating on a land. It's historically humiliating that you didn't even conquer. that you required another great power to conquer on your behalf. It's like, I'm going to bring my dad to deal with you, like, you know.
No, my neighbor's dad to deal with you, basically, and come over. And I mean, so those were lies. The other lie that he mentioned, and it was quite significant, was that the issue is, there's two issues here. Mm. One is, whose state is it implemented in Palestine? Under which ethnicity is privileged?
Yeah, yeah, okay.
So if you want to argue that you have a state that is equal to all races, all ethnicities, or all religions, or whatever, that would be one thing. But to say it must be a Jewish nation state, not a state of, okay, not a state of Canaan, right? Mm-hmm. The Canaanite state, yeah? Mm-hmm. Where any Canaanite is welcome, yeah? Who lives in that land, anyone who has any ancestry of some point to some that can live there as equal citizens, no. They have racial laws that say only one type of ethnicity has the right of return, no matter how much diluted any Levantine connection, any connection to the Levant they're from, even if they're more German than they are Jewish or from the Levant, or they're more Italian than they are, doesn't matter if they've got some identity or even if you have no or ancestry to Palestine, if you actually convert to Judaism, which takes some time, but one, if you convert to Judaism, you can then claim a right of return to Palestine under Israeli laws.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't care about even heritage. They care about
identity, right?
Identity. So anyway, so the other major lie that Benjamin Netanyahu said, and Jordan Peterson did not challenge him on,
yeah,
was the Nakba, was the catastrophe that happened to the Palestinians.
Mm.
And that was one where the argument is, and it's a typical Zionist trope. They say that, so the Palestinians were living with the Jewish migrants that were there, and everyone wanted to live in peace and so on and so forth. But then the Arab armies came in and they told the Palestinians, you have to, you know, leave, so, and then you can go back to your houses after we finish defeating the Jews and driving them into the sea, quote unquote. That's what they'd like to cite. That's just not true. So basically, long story short, Palestine was a bit of a hot potato for Britain. They wanted to extricate themselves from it. It was taking up resources. There were many Jewish organizations that were engaged in active terrorism against the British, because the British tried, yeah, to, the British realized that they shouldn't, that they should not,
like the Irgun, for
give
example,
Palestine to one, to make it a state based on one ethnicity,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Or give with ethnic privilege.
Mm.
So they said, okay, look, when we meant homeland for the Jews, we just meant a place for you to go, but it would be like an equal state for everybody. And the Zionists didn't want that. And they wanted to restrict immigration because, okay, you know, there's complaints about unfair immigration. So we'll listen to the Palestinian concerns and we'll limit the immigration amounts to reasonable levels. The Zionists were in uproar, and that started terror campaigns. Hotels were bombed, King David Hotel.
Yeah.
Ships were bombed. A ship carrying Jewish migrants that were kind of prevented from docking was bombed by Zionist organization to make a point,
mm-hmm,
right? People don't talk about that, right? People don't talk about that. So Jews were being killed by these Zionist terrorists just to make a point about preventing Jewish migration British policy.
British people were being killed as well, right? I mean, that's what we don't realize.
Well, British diplomats and so on, but yeah, but the greater tragedy is not just it's not politicians,
yeah,
it's the men, women and children,
of course,
whether they are Arab or Jew or whoever, who are killed,
yeah,
and they were not involving themselves in fighting and any of this kind of stuff.
Those terrorist organizations later became the Likud party, basically, right? They were absorbed into that party.
Yeah, they became eventually the right wing. So yeah, the Irgun and Lehi eventually would form the right wing parties in Likud. Would basically be their descendants, and recognized as legitimate legal parties.
Imagine if, for example, Osama bin Laden, you know, he had done what he'd done, or whatever, some kind of 7/7 terrorist, or I don't know, whoever, maybe. And then afterwards, they established a political party, and the predecessors, or sorry, the subsequent leaders of that political party, come and now are speaking freely and talking about justice and all these kinds of things. I mean, it wouldn't be acceptable at all. It's absolutely inconceivable. But the fact that this is allowed for Israel, and that this is normal, that this guy can come with a suit and speak about his, he calls it adventures. You know, his military campaigns and his civilians and all of this kind of, his premiership, that he can do that. It beggars belief, I think, you know.
Well, I mean, look, Benjamin Netanyahu, who is a politician, he knows Israeli history, the history of Israeli government, what it's done. He blatantly lied with something that is like GCSE or like secondary school or lower high school, whatever country you're in, incorrect fact. It's not fact. He said that the Israeli state declared independence, and then all the Arab regimes invaded, and that's when the Palestinians were getting kicked out. They weren't kicked out before then. Yeah, that's a lie. When the United Nations adopted the resolution of a partition of Palestine, a partition which, by the way, the Zionists, they said they accepted, but then they started to conquer the areas that was given by the UN to the Palestinians. So this was in 1947, on November, the UN declaration is made. Zionist kind of armed groups, Lehi, Urgun, others, cause instigations, start violence on the ground, and that begins what would become the clearing operations by the Haganah, the main Israeli defense force, of Arab villages. Mm-hmm. Now, they were told by Ben Gurion, said that you can't, that at this time that the Jews were not the majority in Palestine, and Ben Gurion expressed concern that you can't have a viable Jewish state even if the Jews were just 60% of the population. Right, it's still not viable because that 40% Arabs, they could, and just, maybe they get
for
a,
those
a
who don't
ruling
know who's,
party.
Who's Ben Gurion?
So yeah, but Ben Gurion was the first premier of Israel and the lead of the Zionist movement and party, that were in controlling the Zionist movement before they became a government. So he basically expressed what they'd hoped is the world expected. Were looking at them and they couldn't say we're going to make it an ethno state, yeah, for only one ethnic group. They had to. Everyone's talking about democracy. It's after World War II, so they said, okay, we believe in democracy, and yeah, we want everyone to have equal rights, citizenship. So what they were hoping was that they would get enough Jewish immigration into Palestine so that Jews become such a majority that you can have a free democracy. But it will be a Jewish state, a Jewish privileging Jewish language, Jewish identity, because they will be the majority. Mm-hmm. You see? Mm-hmm. And no one could reproach them because they could say, we're a fair, equal state. Everyone's an equal citizenship. We're just a majority Jewish. So that's going to, of course, the state's going to be, you know, of more Jewish character, but that's just democracy. Mm-hmm. Right. But at that point in time, they didn't have enough numbers. Mm-hmm. So they implemented a policy called Plan Dalet, mm-hmm. which was, policy given to all the military commanders that they when they would go, they would basically spread the military force out to all the areas that the UN designate would be a partition to the Jewish state, and beyond into those given to the Palestine state, to get as much of Palestine as possible as quickly as possible. Mm. And any Arab village they encountered, if they offered resistance or should you fight them, if they don't offer resistance still, consider whether they are in a strategic location. If they are, remove them.
Ilan Pape speaks about this in great detail, isn't it? So.
He looks at declassified military files, which shows records written by Israeli military commanders on the ground, right? By the way, this is all before the State of Israel was declared or independent, or even...
Which happens in what, May the 31st, 1948 or something?
So 1948. So this is now 47. It's when it begins. Mm. And so they are clearing Palestinians. They kick out Palestinians, begin clearing operations. They kick out hundreds of thousands of Palestinians before any Arab regime expresses any interest, even any issue. It was actually because of the, there was massacres occurring, there was villages being burnt down, there was refugees being created, which were going into Arabic countries, the surrounding ones. That's when they expressed concern. They demanded the UN act. They said, if they don't, we have to come to rescue our brothers and sisters who are being persecuted and being kicked out, because they're being kicked out already. It's already happening. And you know what the Arab League actually, the ultimatum it made? It wasn't for Jews to leave. It wasn't to be kicked out into the sea. They said, if you know, make it one whole state, not a partition state. Make it one whole state. No one has to leave. Just no more immigration. Just make it right. Like, press the start button. Here's a new state. One whole state. Everyone who's there currently stays there and will be citizens under, you know, equal free democracy. That was the Arab League's proposition. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Zionists don't like to talk about that, but it's official. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they said they proposed it as a solution. But no, because why? Because then Zionists knew that they wouldn't be a majority in that state, and they couldn't get their ethno state with ethnic privilege, you see. And this, so they, of course, they didn't want that. And of course, then the Arab League, they either watched the Palestinians being brutalized and massacred, women getting shot, raped. These things are documented by Israeli commanders, which were declassified and written by Ilan Papp, who is a Jewish Israeli historian who wrote about this. Right? Yes. And Zionists can't answer, because these are declassified documents. You can't argue these are Palestinian forgeries. They were declassified by the Israeli state in their own archives. So these this clearing operation continues until May 1948, and approximately about 700,000 Palestinian Arabs are evicted from their homes. Either they reside in the West Bank, Gaza, or in Syria, Jordan, Egypt, and so on, surrounding, or Lebanon. So that's what happened before the state of Israel is declared independent and what have you. So Benjamin Netanyahu actually lied. The clearing operations, the kicking, the civil war, the Palestinian civil war, started long before the Arab states were intervening, and they only wanted to intervene to stop these things from happening. And they made it, their proposition to resolve the conflict was no partition, make it one unitary state, Arabs, Jews live together under a fair and equal democracy. That was their proposition, not all the Jews get kicked out to the sea. No. Yeah, that came from, I think, some fringe personality in the Muslim world making some rhetoric. But the Arab League's official position, its offered solution was, let's have a unitary state, one state, everyone equal. That was not accepted by the Zionists, because then they would lose ethnic privilege. They wouldn't get the Jewish nation state that Zionism is all about. Zionism isn't about Jews just living in Palestine. It's about Jews getting a privileged rulership over Palestine against other ethnicities. That's why they have racial laws that say only certain types of people or certain types of identity can claim a right to return to Palestine, but not Arabs who can track their ancestry there for centuries and centuries and centuries. Nope, you don't get a right to return back to the country. So if Benjamin Netanyahu talks about justice, why didn't Jordan Peterson call him out on this, which is really basic? I mean, at least read Ilan Papp, maybe even any book Norman by his Norman Finkelstein would have equipped Jordan Peterson with the knowledge to basically deal with this. And so, well,
I think
that was a big issue.
You've summarized it quite well, and I thank you for that. And people can watch your five-hour debate with the head of the
Joseph Cohen.
There's a Zionist lobby or whatever he is, whatever his position is. But you've done these debates quite regularly, and alhamdulillah, you've really summarized this very well. I'm sure Jordan Peterson has watched at least a part of this video. I'm hoping that he watched it, so you can give him more information about these things.
Yeah, because look, the thing is this is not some academic, harmless academic discourse that people should have. This is about people living and dying right now, being persecuted.
Absolutely.
This is an important discussion, not an academic discussion for people in some high tower at university somewhere. This is something that affects people's lives. I mean, the West Bank, people are living behind walls, behind barbed wire, all the characteristics of gulags that Jordan Peterson likes to decry socialists as threatening to call for or to bring in Canada and the United States of America, you know, the apartheid system that exists in Palestine currently. I mean, sure, there's 20%, the 20% population of Israel, Israeli Arabs, yeah, they're not being apartheid, there's no apartheid against them because 20% is a controllable population in a democracy. It allows you to give a facade of a democracy, of a free democracy, because they're small in number. And also, they make good cheap laborers, which, you know, any society, like the ancient world, needs a slave caste to do their cheap labor for them. That's useful. But if you took down all the barriers in the West Bank, which the West Bank, Israel doesn't formally annex it. Why? Because then you'd have to give equal citizenship to all the Palestinians living there and in Gaza. If you were to make it, you know what? If Israel was recognized all the lands it took over as formally part of Israel, it would have to give equal citizenship to everyone there. It wouldn't do so. Why? Because if the walls of Gaza were taken down, if the walls in West Bank around Area A and B, whatever, were taken down, and everyone was given equal citizenship, there would be 50-50 Jews and Palestinian Arabs. Mm-hmm. And that wouldn't make for a Jewish ethnostate. So the Zionists don't want to give the Palestinians equal citizenship, but they don't want to let them have their complete independence because they want to control that land. So they live in this apartheid limbo of not a citizen of Israel, but at the same time, not fully independent state themselves. And they're confined to, dare I say, ghettos, like the Warsaw Ghetto, except this has bigger walls than the Warsaw Ghetto. That was a World War II reference. So that's the situation that's happening in Palestine. It's a serious situation. I think that if Ben Shapiro or Benjamin Netanyahu or any other Zionist had the courage of their convictions, they should face us in public debate and discussion.
They should, yeah.
Yeah. Fair time for each side, you know, protected time. No one will speak over each other. Moderate and everything like this.
Yes.
But now if they are truly think they are just.
Now it's time.
Yeah, if they truly think they are just, engage us in public debate. We're not afraid.
Absolutely.
So what's their excuse?
I don't think they have one. And if they dodge justice, I think now the reason why they are doing so, I've made many videos about Ben Shapiro here, and his very famous videos, hundreds of thousands, I'm sure you've seen them. And I've already spoken to his colleague Jordan Peterson twice. He knows who I am. He knows who we are. He's seen this video, or at least parts of it. And if it's a no, then, you know, you're punching a punching bag. You know, the heavy bag, they call it in boxing. The heavy bag doesn't punch back. When Netanyahu can speak and he can make all these ridiculous claims and it goes unchecked and he thinks he's, you know, that's not going to punch. There's no, Jordan Peterson's not going to, you know, be able to punch back.
Canadian psychiatrists aren't really going to offer you much of a
resistance,
not of a pushback, despite what they might promise they're going to do.
Yeah, and so this is where it is. If you're men, if you're true, if you're really men, Netanyahu and Shapiro and Co and these, if you're real men, you know, then why don't you face us? I mean, this is exactly right.
Yeah, we're waiting, you know.
We're waiting for the
send location.
They send a location, you know. I would say that except for, I wouldn't do it in so-called Israel. And the reason why is because we have to fear for our safety as well, brother. You know, as soon as we go there, we know the story of Muslims going into that place and being roughed up by the people. So it has to be in the West somewhere. We'll be there. You know, this helium-voiced individual, Ben Shapiro, you know, and Netanyahu, 2-on-2, you know, why not? You know, and Netanyahu, you know, let's see if he's got, if he's talking about adventures and being a big man, and this, I don't know how old he is now, 70 years old or 70, 80 years old.
But you know what, I make the invitation open to all the Zionists, so if you want to...
But they have to have some level, you know. You're now, you know.
Any Zionists that pretend to be have any repute? Well, no, like
you're one of the heavyweights in the debating scene. We have to vet these guys and see what their levels are.
Well, probably literally now, but what I'd say is that if they pretend any repute, then if they are a advocate for the Zionism and they are basically confident about it, engage us. We'll have a fair platform. Engage us because we'll call out. That it will call out lies that are typically mentioned, just like Benjamin Netanyahu said that in his interview with Jordan Peterson, you know, Israel was attacked in the Six-Day War, And you know, like after they you know prayed Israel, they were attacked in the Six-Day War, and they forget that the 1957 Suez Crisis, they attacked Egypt without provocation, and in the Six-Day War, it wasn't Egyptian army going into Israel, you know, it was Israeli army going into Sinai attacking Egypt down there too. So the lie upon lie. So if you do have the courage of real conviction, then face us, please.
Yeah, please face us. Maybe you'll need to take a few tablets beforehand or some drugs or something. Do what is necessary, because now you're going to lose face in the community.
And at the very least, we can show the world the true face of Zionists, the weakness of their arguments, because said the Palestinian brothers and sisters, or the ultimately as Muslims, it should be us to solve the problem.
Yes.
But the plight of the Palestinians must be known accurately, conveyed accurately to the rest of the world to bear witness to justice, inshallah.
Inshallah. With that, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Hey you, are you wasting your time on social media again? Your brothers and sisters in IslamNet from Norway are establishing a masjid, a dawah center. Establishing a masjid to convey the message of Islam is one of the best deeds a Muslim can do. There's a huge need for it in Norway. You know this and I know this. So that makes the reward even greater. So give generously and Allah Azza wa Jal will give you even more.